First case for argument this morning is 21-1488, American Federation of Government Employees versus the Air Force. Mr. Mangan, whenever you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May I take the mask off?
Yes, please do. Yeah, comfortable.
May it please the Court, my name is Glenn Mangum. I'm from San Antonio, Texas, and I'm representing Michael Johnson, who is the movant in this case. Mr. Johnson has moved to be substituted as the petitioner for the AFG Locals 1367, who originally filed the petition for review in this case. I'm here today to persuade you that not only is the substitution of Mr. Johnson appropriate, but also that the petition for review has merit. That is, that the decision that was made by the Air Force to remove Mr. Johnson was not supported by substantial evidence, did not comply with the requirements of the law, and the arbitrator's decision affirming that decision to remove Mr. Johnson was likewise fatally flawed.
So let's start with your first point. Maybe it's a coincidence or maybe not, but it seems like very recently we've had a lot of activity here on this substitution question and on the statutory provision, which leads us to starting at Reed. I mean, it has long been this court's view, has it not, that the way the statute is written, if you're appealing an arbitrator's award, you're sort of doing it under the MSPB rules, which means it needs to be the employee that is the moving party on appeal here. That's been our longstanding law. We've had it recently in non-PREC opinions. We started in 86 with the Reed case. Whether that's the right or the wrong answer, it's the answer under the statute, and it's the answer under our case law. How do you avoid that here?
Judge, I agree with you. I think that only the aggrieved employee has standing to file a petition for review from either a board decision or an arbitrator decision. In this case, what we're asking to do is to be substituted as the real party in interest. That is, even though the union, as the union itself, did not have standing to file the petition for review, it was acting on behalf of Mr. Johnson, as it had acted since he initiated the grievance challenging his removal. So that we think that Mr. Johnson should be allowed to substitute because he is the real party in interest. If we deny him,
how do you get around the federal rule 43B?
Well,
that's your problem right there,
Judge. I don't think that rule 43B really tells us the answer to the question that is before the court. It doesn't provide much guidance to the court in this particular factual situation.
For there to be substitution, that the original party was a proper party to the suit.
I don't think that's a requirement of the law, Judge.
Well, it doesn't say that explicitly. I think one could argue very forcefully that implicitly it does say that. But other circuits who have looked at it have persuasively argued that that's the way it should be applied. So what you would ask us to do is read this rule in a different way, in a way different than our sister circuits have construed it, which is precisely the way Judge Reyna said it's been construed.
Well, I agree with what you're saying, Judge, but I think the cases that you're referring to confront a different factual situation that we have before us today. The Mullaney versus Anderson case, I believe, is dispositive of the motion to substitute Mr. Johnson as petitioner in this case, because in that case, the case was before the Supreme Court of the United States, and a motion for substitution was made at that stage of the process to allow the petitioner to name.
Well, I guess I take your point, and I read Mullaney, and you're right, it's the best thing you have going for you. The problem I have there, a number of problems. One, it's not, Mullaney isn't Rule 43, it's Rule 21 of the Rules of Civil Procedure.
You understand that, Judge.
So you've never argued Rule 21 of the Rules of Civil Procedure. And Mullaney is cited in gray, but I don't believe you cited it in blue. So it may, in fact, present a new and different argument, not resting on Rule 43, but resting on Rule 21 and the joinder provisions that may or may not have any heft. But how can you argue you've necessarily preserved that? Rule 21 is a different rule, and it's joinder, and it may and may not work here, because here you're not talking about joinder. You're talking about really substitution of the party.
That's correct, Judge.
But we haven't had briefing or fulsome briefing. I mean, you've got the case and nothing more cited in Gray. So I don't know what to do with that. But in our normal rules, we'd say that's an argument that hasn't been made in a fulsome way and hasn't been properly preserved. So what's your response to that?
Well, Judge, I think we have properly preserved it by arguing that the Mullaney case, which was cited with approval by this court in both the Unilock case and the Mojave Desert case, with approval, that it stands for the proposition that if there's a technical error in the initiation of the petition for review, that this court should allow substitution of the real party in interest, so that the court has.
And here, I think we have that. I think we have exactly what you're talking about. There's a reason why substitution should be permitted. Otherwise, in my view, there's an injustice here.
That's exactly my point, too, Judge.
Yes. However, you have another rule that you're faced up with that really creates the injustice, and this goes back to 43B. The original party in this suit did not have jurisdiction. And the way I read 43B, that means that you don't either. That's the injustice. Now, how do we get out of that?
Well, Judge, we're not arguing that Mr. Johnson should be substituted because he is a successor in interest to the union, or he has somehow received a transfer of their interest in the matter to him. We're arguing that had the union not made the error of filing the petition in its own name rather than in the name of the grievant, Michael Johnson, that we wouldn't even be talking about
now,
this question.
Give me some authority to back up what you just said.
Well, I think the Mullaney versus Anderson case, as it was cited in...
There was no error. I mean, there was no real error there. I mean, it was a different kind of a case. And one of the things the Supreme Court rested on in that case, I think I recall right correctly, is that we're already here at the end of the road at the Supreme Court. I think it was a real question whether or not they even needed to bring in these employees. And, but I mean, why isn't the answer to Judge Reyna's question that, you know, the statute is a statute? We might have written it differently, but the statute is quite clear. It's been around for a long time. Our cases have been quite clear that the employee should have come in at the beginning on the notice of appeal. So whether, as you say, the union, I don't know what term you use, anyway, screwed up or whatever, or dropped the ball, that's something we deal with all the time. And that's the kind of maybe injustice when a lawyer doesn't do what they should have done or so forth. But that doesn't mean that we change the rules.
I'm not suggesting that the statute should be changed or that the interpretation of the statute should be changed. I'm just saying that as the aggrieved employee, Mr. Johnson should be allowed to substitute so that he has the opportunity to challenge the propriety of his removal.
Well, let's move on, if my colleagues are okay with that, to the merits, because, I mean, even if we may or may not be able to reach them. But frankly, if you get to the merits of this case, I really have my doubts how the arguments you make can prevail. And here's my problem. You seem to make a lot of process arguments on due process, which are very unusual. You make an argument that I'm not sure I've ever seen before, which is they applied too lenient a standard rather than too tough a standard. So I don't know where that gets you, even if you're right, and I don't think you're right. I'm having applied preponderance versus substantial evidence.
I would concede that, Judge.
Okay. So then you're left predominantly with kind of due process arguments about the deficiency of the notice. And, I mean, you do the proposed removal. I don't see how it's deficient. It's quite clear to me, and I think it was clear to your client, what the problem was here and what he did. Now, he may have disputed that, but I don't see how you have a due process or a process argument in terms of the specificity of the notice. I understand why strategically you may pick that argument, because otherwise you've got substantial evidence review of the facts, and that's really impossible, almost impossible to overcome. But did he not know? He was the supervisor. The rule was clear that there has to be some degree of separation, and there are real consequences to what gets done in this context as opposed to a lot of the other cases we have.
Yes, ma'am.
Where's the due process violation in terms of the specificity of the notice? Isn't that what your argument is? Am I correctly stating your argument?
Well, Judge, you are. But let me expound on it a little bit. Throughout its brief, the Air Force argues that the arbitrator made certain findings that would satisfy the agency's burden of proof to support the removal decision. That is, that the charged conduct occurred, that there was a nexus between the charged conduct and the efficiency of the service, and that the penalty of removal was appropriate. The problem with that statement is that it's not true. The arbitrator made no explicit findings on any of those subjects. The only reference to the efficiency of the service that was made by the agency was in the amended notice of proposed removal. The arbitrator himself made only certain findings that were not consistent with the requirements of the burden of proof that the agency had. That is, he said the grievant received due process as was treated fairly during the disciplinary process. Well, that just means that the grievant, Mr. Johnson, was given the right to reply in writing and orally, and that reply was considered before a decision was made.
Counsel, can I ask you, the Air Force also argues that you have forfeited your due process arguments. Can you show us where they were raised?
In terms of whether they were raised before the arbitrator?
Yes.
Is that what you're asking, Judge?
Yeah, they're affirmative defenses.
I don't believe they were.
And so why are they not forfeited?
Because I'm here today. I don't know the answer to that question, Judge, other than I'm arguing again and have been arguing in my briefs that the sins of the union should not be visited upon my client, Mr. Johnson. I really think that this court has the ability to give him the chance to prove that his removal was not appropriate.
And I heard you say that before, too. Is there something in the record we can point to that says it was an error, it was a sin of the union, or is that just something you're telling us now?
Well, I think it's obvious from the fact that we're arguing about whether or not Mr. Johnson should be allowed to be substituted.
Right, but I was really wondering, why is Mr. Johnson not the original appellant? And you're telling me today it was an error, but
because
do I have something in the record that
because he relied on the union to do what was appropriate for him. Judge, that's the only answer to the question that I have, and that is he had been relying on the union to advocate for him in terms of grieving the decision to remove him, and relied again on the union in doing the right thing in terms of initiating this petition for review.
Just moving back, though, to the merits and the deficiency, I mean, even if preserved, I'm not understanding or appreciating your due process and the deficiency of the notice of proposed removal. This wasn't a complicated set of events. We all know the basis. We understand and appreciate the incident. There's one incident, and it's what led to his removal. And we all understood easily, I think everyone understands, you may disagree whether what he did or did not do rose to a sufficient basis for removing him. But we all know what happened. And are you arguing that he didn't know, even though he was a supervisor, that he should have been supervising? I mean, I guess you seem to be saying the notice was deficient because
it was not in sufficient detail as required by the Air Force regulations.
What was it missing? What was the notice missing?
Okay.
So he didn't know what he was being charged with?
The charge was careless performance of assigned duties.
Yeah.
The only reference to assigned duties was the fact that he was the watch supervisor.
Right.
And
he's a watch supervisor, and these planes got too close, and that was a violation of the rules, and he was supervising the two trainees who were in charge of doing that. I mean, there may be, the notice doesn't have to be beginning to end, chapter and verse. That's why you have a trial and everything else.
Well, how was he to defend himself, Judge, if he didn't know exactly what it was that the Air Force was charging him with doing?
He didn't know.
What did he?
The problem he was charged with was that he didn't appropriately supervise these people so that it allowed them to get too close. He didn't know that?
He knew what the allegation was, Judge. He didn't know what a duty was assigned to him that he failed to perform. Where does it say that he has to ensure that not a trainee, but another controller who was supervising the trainee, who authorized the trainee to release the aircraft?
Well, Counselor, this wasn't the first time he was charged with this. I mean, there was prior instances where he was charged with a similar type of negligence.
That's true, Judge.
He seems to have experience in this area, so why wouldn't he have known, you know, the last time around that what he was being charged with and what the problem was? This is a smart person we're talking about. I mean, he's a supervisor in an air traffic control tower.
He was the watch supervisor on that day, Judge. Yes, I don't dispute what you're saying, Judge. I'm just saying that the requirement of specificity that is required by Air Force regulation and by the merit system principles requires that the agency specify what it is exactly that he did or didn't do that caused this incident to occur, and they didn't do that. The arbitrator found that he violated certain regulations that weren't even alleged in the notice of proposed removal or the amended notice of proposed removal. How can we sustain an arbitrator's decision when he makes up violations of regulation that weren't even alleged in the notice of proposed removal? I don't understand that.
Okay, we're well into we've used your rebuttal time, which we will restore. Why don't we turn to the government?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good morning. Is it Mr. Ho?
Huff, Your Honor. Good morning.
Okay. Good morning.
May it please the Court, Stephen Huff for the respondent, the United States Department of the Air Force. This appeal should be dismissed because the union lacks standing to bring it. Mr. Johnson did not file a timely petition for review, and he may not be substituted for the union as a petitioner in this matter.
Counselor, let's take a look at this Rule 43B. I have a problem when the application of a particular rule that's in effectively a technicality creates such an injustice. And the injustice here is that we have an individual who's been kept out of the courtroom. The courtroom doors were slammed shut in his face because the union could no longer represent him. And the union had the rug pulled out from under their feet, defunded, destructured, dissolved, and the only person left to carry this forward is his client. And yet 43B says that's not possible. Is 43B really intended to apply in a situation such as this that results in what would be a manifest injustice?
Your Honor, it is intended to apply in this situation, and I think the answer is what Your Honor said in your recent concurring opinion in the AFG Local 3438 versus Social Security case. Your Honor closed, these anomalies are the necessary result of the statutory scheme created by Congress and must be corrected, if at all, by Congress.
Yeah, we're dealing with the same anomaly here, but under a different factual situation. Here, the union just no longer existed. It was totally unable to represent, not because of an attorney got sick or circumstances like that. I mean, the union just ceased to exist. So this is a different factual situation than what the one you're citing with respect to my concurrence or my additional views that I wrote.
Your Honor, it's not my understanding that the local union ceased to exist, and that's certainly not in the record. My understanding is in response to our motion to dismiss, the local union, under prior counsel, responded that the national union had told it could take no further action. That's no different than if a parent corporation tells a subsidiary to stop acting, or indeed if a director or a CEO of a corporation tells its company it's pulling the funding, it can't move forward. But in any event, Your Honor, it's a conjunctive test. Substitution is only permitted both if the original party is incapable of continuing and the original party is proper. Neither of those prongs is met here.
In other words, you're saying the situation posited doesn't matter because the reason he's got a problem here is not because the union was forced to drop out for financial situations. If the union had stayed in, he'd have the same problem, which is the union can't be representing it him. He has to appeal it himself.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Let me ask you, I'm a little confused, and I was confused. I had a case a couple months ago that involved the same issue. The government doesn't seem to be arguing the case that we've been talking about for 35 years, which is Reed, and how the statute says it has to be the employee. You're making this Hunt argument, which seems different. And even though you gave us a 28J letter citing AFGE in the recent cases, you're making a different argument. You're not making, I don't think, the Reed argument that was made in the case, in Judge Reyna's case in AFGE, right?
Your Honor, I'm less familiar with those two cases, admittedly. However, we did cite Reed throughout our brief, throughout our motion to dismiss, and the ultimate conclusion
of
those cases.
Of course you're familiar with those cases. You wrote a 28J letter about those cases.
To that extent, certainly, Your Honor.
Well, so you must have read them.
Yes, Your Honor, the decisions.
And they very much stand for, do they not, the fact that it's not a Hunt problem here. It's the statute says you follow what procedures are for the MSPB. It has to be the employee that appeals this, even if it's an arbitration award. That's what we did in Reed. That's what we said in FOP. That's what we said in the AFGE case. That's not a Hunt kind of argument. That's a different argument. Are you not getting what I'm saying?
I think I understand the distinction, Your Honor. As I recall, one of AFGE Local 3438 and one of the Fraternal Order of Police cases, one relied more on the statutory scheme, I think Your Honor's referring to, and the other relied upon more of the constitutional scheme, but both ultimately held there was no standing for the union. Does that answer the court's question?
Well, not exactly. Can I just ask you, you may not have the answer to this question, but this goes to Judge Reyna's question, which I understand and have sympathy for, about closing the doors of justice to people. But, I mean, I think here your answer is that we've had this, the law has been good for 35 years. Maybe this is anecdotal, but I didn't recall ever being on a case in the 20 years I've been on the court until a few months ago that raised this problem of the union still being the party that filed the notice of appeal in an arbitration award. And so we did a little, I mean, in most of these cases, people read the statute and got it right? I mean, in the vast majority of cases that involve appeals of an arbitration award, the employee moves in as the appropriate party and it's not an issue, right? We haven't had very many cases that pose this problem.
I assume that's correct, Your Honor. I don't have statistics to cite for you. Certainly, if there were many more of them at our disposal, I think we would have cited them in the motion to dismiss.
And we've got a fair number of cases where the employee and the union have opted to go the arbitration versus the MSPB route. So one would assume if this issue wasn't presented, the parties read the statute in our case law and figured it out, and the employee was the party that filed the notice of appeal.
I would assume that as well, Your Honor, and of course the court would have a sua sponte obligation to determine standing issues as well, even if a party didn't raise the issue.
Should we look at this issue differently than our sister circuits by virtue of the fact that there is this option to follow the MSPB route, and we have sole jurisdiction over that option? And so does that require a special interpretation by this court on the applicability of 43B?
It does not, Your Honor. I think, in fact, it counsels the other direction. Mr. Johnson could have gone through the MSPB procedure in the first place rather than the union procedure. He elected to grieve with the union. Had he gone the MSPB route, there'd be no problem. He would be properly before the court today.
Yeah, but I think, we don't penalize people because they chose arbitration versus the MSPB, right?
It's not a matter of penalty, Your Honor. It's a matter of jurisdiction and standing.
And incidentally, if I recall correctly, the national union placed the local union, the one we're talking about, in receivership and issued a command to it that it withdrew all authorization for it to continue representation in this case.
I believe that was the substance of the response to our motion to dismiss, that they were not allowed to respond to the motion or engage in any further litigation or advocacy, or to that effect, Your Honor.
Yeah, they were in receivership, and they got they got an order from the national organization that withdrew authorization for it to continue. It just, you know, just take those facts under consideration.
I mean, to follow up, I mean, doesn't that mean that they were incapable of continuing to litigate?
I would disagree with that, Your Honor. Incapability, and I know, too, we're talking Rule 43B, of course. 43A refers to the death of the party. I think there's some parallelism to be seen there. The examples of incapability are much stronger than that, Your Honor. Incapability, this court has found before, has occurred where a party has become incompetent, when a transfer of interest has occurred, or the focus of litigation has shifted. That's the Mojave Desert case, a holdings case relying upon more federal practice. None of those situations are implicated here. As I suggested to the panel earlier, this is much more similar to a situation where a parent corporation tells a subsidiary it can't keep going. Right. The owner of a company tells a company it can't.
Let me ask you about the other requirement that you would have us read into 43B. We have never before said, have we, that the rule is limited to where the original appellant was a proper party? Have we ever said that? I mean, I think you cite a 9th and 11th Circuit case that says that, but I don't know that you cite a Federal Circuit case where we've ever said that.
I believe you're correct in that, Your Honor. We cited Sable from the 9th Circuit and Silberman from the 11th.
And so the requirement's not in the literal language of the rule, is it?
No, I don't believe so.
So why should we read it into it?
Your Honor, otherwise would allow situations like this where very late in the day, after the statutory jurisdictional time for petition review to be filed has elapsed, after the time to move to intervene has passed, for a party to come in late. In fact, this case was resurrected after being dismissed because the wrong party had brought it. There's no reason to diverge from the other circuits and the well-established law there.
What about, we asked your friend about a case cited in Gray, Mulvaney. And I think he's right that that seems more helpful than a lot of the other things he cited in Lewis. Do you have a view about Mulvaney, which rested not, as I recall, on Rule 43B, but on Rule 21? Do you have a view on the applicability of that?
I do, Your Honor, and I agree with that distinction. First, as the court noted, those arguments were waived because they were not presented in the opening brief. They were, Mulvaney was not cited. Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 21 was not cited. On the merits, there are also several problems and distinctions with Mulvaney. First, as the court observed, that concerns not substitution under Rule 43B, but rather Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 21, which concerns dropping misjoined parties and adding non-joined parties. Indeed, as Reagan Miller has stated, several courts have held that Rule 21 contemplates the retention of one or more parties in the action, and it's not a method of substituting the sole plaintiff or the sole defendant in the action, which would result here. In addition, in the Mulvaney case, the union there was the, quote, avowed agent of its members. That was not the case here. As the court previously noted at ECF number 13, the union filed the appeal to this court on its own behalf, and in fact, the union certificate of interest at ECF number 5 confirmed as the only entity then represented by petitioner's counsel. Moreover, in Mulvaney, the original plaintiffs were deemed the proper parties below, and the union standing was not questioned for the first time until the Supreme Court. That's simply not the case here. The Air Force identified this issue in its docketing statement at ECF number 8, and we promptly moved to dismiss for lack of standing at ECF number 10. Finally, both this court and the Supreme Court have held that the authority to join or dismiss a party on appeal under Federal Rule of Civil Procedure 21 should be exercised sparingly. That's the Newman Green versus Alfonso Lorraine case, Supreme Court, 1989, and this court's case in Primatech 2 versus ARU from 2000. In Primatech, the appellant had specifically challenged a standing in the district court, so the facts of this case didn't warrant the exercise of that power.
Okay, let me move you on before your time runs out to sort of part two, which we may never get to, but on the merits of the case, you heard your friend's due process arguments and about the deficiency of the notice of appeal, that it didn't give enough notice, I guess, as to what his client's responsibilities were or should have been in that context, and that the agency should have cited that in the in proposed notice of removal to put him on notice about what he should challenge or present.
Yes, Your Honor. We would argue the notice was more than sufficient under the standard both for the notice and also under the deferential sufficiency of the evidence standard of review. However, I also note that the affirmative defenses that the court observed have been waived As my colleague admitted, they were not presented to the arbitrator. They're not properly before this court. And in addition, due process does not require perfect process, and Mr. Johnson has the burden of proof on those affirmative defenses.
Do you think there was legitimately any ambiguity as this process evolved, starting with the notice and moving forward, as to what the agency was, the basis which the agency was removing him?
No, Your Honor. There are three separate incidents in a span of 8 months where Mr. Johnson, an experienced air traffic controller, allowed planes while he was supervising the watchtower to get too close to each other. It could have caused an accident. It could have caused loss of human
life. Was there ambiguity as to whether, as a supervisor in the tower at the time of this last incident, he had some responsibility to do something?
No, Your Honor.
Thank you.
For these reasons, we respectfully request that the court dismiss the petition or, in the alternative, affirm the judgment of the arbitrator.
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Madigan, you used your rebuttal, but we'll restore 2 minutes if you need it.
3 minutes.
2 minutes.
Judge, I'll start with what Mr. Huff just said. It is incumbent upon the Air Force, if they're going to remove an employee, to state with specificity, to provide exactly what delinquency he committed that justifies them removing him. In this case, they said, you allowed such and such to happen. Well, how did he allow that to happen? Did he tell the air traffic controller who was in charge of the trainee who released the aircraft?
Has it been his position that he had no authority to do anything about this and no supervisory authority over what was going on in the tower at that time?
No, Judge, that's not his
position. So that's not in dispute that
his position is, as the watch supervisor, my responsibility is to maintain situational awareness. That does not mean that I have to second guess every decision that every person under my supervision may make that day. In his defense, he said not only was the trainee well experienced to release the aircraft, but also so was the controller in charge.
So, given his position at that time, your view is that if something had gone wrong, it had nothing to do with him because the other people had authority to stop it as well?
No, he was supervising the controller in charge, Judge. He testified that...
So don't supervisors have an ultimate responsibility to make sure that somebody doesn't mess up so that there won't be some catastrophic event occurring?
Yes, Judge, they do. I agree with that proposition. In this case, though, if you read the record, what he said was, at the time that the aircraft were allowed to take off, everything that had needed to be done had been done. And it was only because there were unforeseen circumstances that occurred after they were given permission to take off that caused this particular incident or problem to occur.
Is he saying that there was no, that they were, it was impossible, that they were unforeseen? And nobody could have stopped it at that point? No, he had the ability to intervene and correct the situation, right?
He could not have intervened after the aircraft were given clearance to take off because he testified that once they leave the runway, they are no longer under the control of the Air Force traffic controller. They are under the control of the local San Antonio Air Control Tower. The only thing he could have done would be to notify the San Antonio Air Traffic Control Tower. But they were already aware of the situation and were taking steps to correct it.
Anything further?
Pardon?
Anything further?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you. We thank both sides in the case.
Thank you, judges.